He has been absent for a couple of weeks, but not really absent. He has been traveling around Europe. The media beat has been moving from place to place, and it all depends when he's in the air or not, whether or not we get him on the air. But we've got him on the air this week. It's time for David Taraschuk with the Media Beat. David, of course, is a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. He's got his own great website, which is themediabeat.us, and it's nice to welcome him back on the air. Good morning, David.
Reporting in again from Europe, not from the media capital of the world, New York City, my more regular home base, but all the same, joining as ever with the sharp-eyed Marshall Miles. I'm in Dublin, Ireland again, Marshall, but as you said, since our last talk, I've been taking trips to both France and Britain. And Britain remains strongest in my mind after this stretch of reporting, because the media there are an especially high-pitched hum, can I say. It's tempting to say, chiming in with the typical press hyperbole in Britain, that the country is in utter chaos. That's the word that keeps coming up in newspaper headlines. What's undeniable is that the country is in the grip of escalating and potentially crippling labor disputes. They're all happening against a background of severe economic trouble. Roaring inflation to the fore in Britain, what English press language simply calls a cost of living crisis. I mean, they're running at the highest rate of inflation they've known for 40 years. So while Europe's economies, which Britain, of course, has split itself off from by Brexit, they're generally recovering from the recessionary effects of the COVID pandemic and are now growing again. Britain has actually suffered shrinkage in its economy in the last 3 months, and further contraction is threatened for next year. So Britain's Conservative government, in short, is in battle mode, and there are massive public sector strikes going on. They're taking place in the long revered National Health Service, that Britain is so famous for, and the country's network of railroads, already being hit by currently terrible weather by British standards, snow bringing cancellations as well as staff walking off the job. But also striking have been workers in the National Postal Service, the Royal Mail, as it's called. We just can't get away from that word, Royal, when we come to Britain. highway maintenance workers, bus drivers, and airport baggage handlers, too. Newspapers are now having to publish color-coded calendars to help readers keep track of what services will be interrupted on what date. But I have to say that the most emblematic labor dispute at the moment involves the nurses. Now, if you're going to take on labor unions, which is how this current government is generally playing things now, doubling down and refusing to consider any offers of higher wage settlements, then I'd suggest the most unwise choice of all is to take on the nurses. I mean, here you come up against a definite British thing, if you like, the Florence Nightingale syndrome, you know, that revered wartime nurse of Victorian days who became a national hero during the Crimean War, in fact, echoes of Ukraine now, and she is totally embedded in the national psyche. The lady with the lamp who walked around taking care of wounded soldiers, such an icon of British culture. The nurses, some of them are really revering her as a spiritual guide almost, certainly a role model universally. They have their own union, though it has the grand name of the Royal College of Nursing. I told you, you can't get away from the word royal reporting on Britain. And that's even while I'm ignoring the Harry and Meghan TV series, which I do, and I hope you'll respect my judgment in that. I don't want to talk about it. But let's talk about the Royal College of Nursing. It is a union, despite its name. Yesterday, it kicked into action its first ever strike in 100 years of its history, with another one planned for next week. it won't call off its strike action unless the government agrees to talk to it about a wage claim they're making for 19% rise. The government, on its side, is trying to hide behind a kind of transparent fiction that it's there's an independent wage bargaining body that sets hospital pay rates, even though it's the government that sets that body's overall budget and is in overall control of its membership. And the nurses are simply not having this. As with all national conflicts, labor and political conflicts both, the press is taking sides. The popular tabloid The Mirror is loudly backing the nurses, while the reputedly upscale and definitely conservative The Daily Telegraph is making lots of tut-tut noises about the government having to be careful about how it spends taxpayers' money. But it's very interesting to see that the Daily Express, which is also conservative, but is in the tabloid category, really, and its careful antennae for popular feeling has it supporting the nurses. Its front page headline, filling the entire page today, says, "For the nurses, for Britain, sit down and sort this out." That's a good headline writing words, but they're actually quoting a senior Tory party figure, a supporter of the government, in fact, a very large voice in that government, although he's not currently a cabinet member. And of course, the Daily Express, in using that quotation, they're also taking into full account public opinion polling that shows that the British people are very, very fully behind the nurses. And I think, you know me and my Scottish background and so on, it's worth noting that in Scotland, the devolved government there has decided, unlike the English authorities, to talk directly with the nurses and even an increased pay offer. So there's been no nurses' strike north of the border in Scotland. It looks like the Scottish nurses will be accepting that offer as well, according to those early surveys. So that's the seed in Britain.
You know, it's interesting, and correct me if I'm wrong, but way back when Brexit first came up, wasn't one of the things that people who did not support breaking away from the European Union was that the fact that there's a certain amount of safety in being part of the Union where you weren't quite as open to what's happening right now?
Oh, well, yes. I mean, the membership of the European community was to enable you to take part in a combined single market economy. One of the things that's very clearly happened since Brexit, and to nobody's surprise who has studied these things carefully, being out of step with the remaining 27 members of the European bloc, means that you are out of step, and you can't partake of what is generally speaking a shared improvement in economies, which is what's happening in Europe as a whole now. Not universally so, not through every single country, but the general trend now is clearly for recovery, and things are looking up for Europe as a whole. However, not for Europe, and there are simple little tiny examples of it. I just got annoyed this morning myself in a small domestic matter. I had to have something shipped from Britain to Ireland. Both once members of Europe, and Britain, of course, no longer a member of Europe. So guess what? There are customs charges on this item, which cost me £20, or roughly $20 or $18 to buy in London. But $30. I'm getting my numbers wrong already. But after paying $30 or thereabouts, maybe about $26, I'd say, I then had to pay $20 worth of customs charges. and the same happens in reverse. If you're receiving something from Europe, there's a chance if you're living in Britain, that you can be slammed unexpectedly with customs charges, and that's not conducive to frictionless trade and the kind of trade that encourages recovery and growth.
You know, when I looked at the stories, and I have been following them, and by the way, I have not followed the Harry and Meghan story. That is a... what was it, a couple of years ago? The strikes and the riots when Macron was trying to do something with the economy. It took France a while to come out of it. They're not still completely out of it, but it's nothing compared to what appears to be going on in Britain.
Sure. I mean, it's almost ironic because the Brits have had for some time, ever since the Thatcher years anyway, we've looked down their noses at France's apparent incapacity for keeping industrial peace for a length of time, and its long-lasting record for public sector strikes especially. But the boot is on the other foot now, it seems. Not that France are entirely strike-free at the moment. There almost always there's some dispute going on, but nothing like these vast countrywide stoppages that are afflicting mainly England now, although the other parts of the United Kingdom are being hit by them inevitably. With that exception that I did mention, that there's no nurses' strike in Scotland, even though the strike has hit England hard and Wales and in fact Northern Ireland. The leadership of the nurses, by the way, is now the leadership of that Royal College of Nursing is in the hands of Northern Ireland trained and Northern Ireland born nurses, one in particular who is a firebrand but also a very, very emblematic kind of nurse herself. She's managed to project to the public a combination of steely resolve and compassion for patients. So it's an interesting piece of campaigning going on. The political resolve, because it is a political matter, that's what it's become. It's become a battle with the Conservative government by the Labour movement. And these nurses are in the forefront of it, combining, as I say, a capacity for justice seeking, in their terms, with the determination that they don't want their own patients to suffer. It's a threading of a needle that has to be done, and it seems to be winning. As I mentioned earlier, the polling suggests that it seems to be winning the hearts of the British public.
All right, let's move over for a second. Seeing you've been traveling throughout Europe. Is the response to what's going on in Ukraine still on the front burner in Europe?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Much more so than I suspect, or as far as I can gather from my distance from the United States. Yes, I mean, you just cannot get past the sensation of being in a continent that is at war. I haven't been anywhere near the front, but many people here are very clear about their sense of it being a close conflict, not some far and distant involvement by other people. It's a curious sensation. And certainly very different from when I was in New York and Washington. There's a sense of its immediacy, which is still strong, even though there's inevitably a falling off of enthusiasm about supporting Ukraine. But it's not sort of falling off to the point of being unwilling, far from it. The willingness is still here. It's just settling into a more of a kind of solid determination to keep on Ukraine's side. even though the first flurry of kind of blue and yellow flag waving, which was so very evident 9 months ago, is perhaps not as fervent as it was then.
You look at the news of Ukrainians attacking where strategic bombers have been sitting, and Russia is now using those strategic bombers to send off missiles in that way. And you also look at what they've done and mass attacks that they've done in different sections in the east and in the northeast, and then also where there might be now a section where Belarus might join in with Russia and try to send troops in. It's certainly a situation that continues to be tinder for a major fire, honest to gosh.
Sure, it's major, and it remains major in the minds of, I'm going to say, everyone in Europe. I can't say that with absolute certainty, but there's a general feeling that this is very much our fight, even if we're not we. Speaking as I guess the West, the rest of the world besides Russia, is how someone cased it the other day. Britain's main Royal Institute of, again that word, Royal, the Institute for International Affairs, more popularly known as, more informally known as Chatham House, was having a session to discuss the state of the war, and they described it as Russia's war on everybody else, and we, as everybody else, are involved, is the way that the European argument goes. From the United States, perhaps less so, but it has to be said that the Ukrainians themselves and most of the Europeans who are on their side are constant in their recognition of the value of the Biden administration's support for Ukraine too, even if it's got its limits, and there's certainly a concern in Washington about not wanting to be too provocative to the great Russian bear. That seems to be still at the back of many American strategic thinkers' minds, and you can understand why. And there is that greater sense of distance. The Atlantic, after all, is the Atlantic, and we're that much further away. But yes, it's still the most predominant feature of the international scene here, looking at it from Europe.
And once again, the potential leader of the Republican Party in the House mentions that it will not be an open checkbook for Ukraine once they take over power of the House.
Sure. Yeah, there's always that sense that you can't ultimately totally depend upon an administration's will in such international matters. Europeans are well aware of that the U.S. Congress is an equal arm of, perhaps not equal, but a distinct arm of government too, besides the executive branch, and we have to recognize that. American news has actually penetrated the British media fog of domestic concerns a bit this week. They've taken note of Joe Biden's decision to release National Archive records about the John F. Kennedy assassination. That's something that's gone down very interestingly here. Lots of reports about the deluge of new documents, but newly available documentation that people who want to study this matter can sink themselves in. Though I have to say that the overall consensus here is that this release of documentation is not likely to make, not likely to dampen down all the conspiracy theorists' continuing insistence on developing, well, theories. The theories will continue, I suspect.
And has news reached Europe about Donald Trump's digital trading cards?
I have to say yes. So often, European coverage of United States is accompanied by a massive media eye rolling, of course. Nothing gets Europeans' eyes rolling more than Trump. And yes, the trading cards with Trump as a kind of superhero with red flanked thighs the size of tree trunks is quite something. And if you're a media person, certainly in the visual side of the media, you can't resist this here. It's ridiculous here as it is, I'm sure, in New York and Washington.
Well, you know, the thing that, by the way, the media not only rolled their eyes but flipped their wig here. But what the one thing that I sit here and I say when it comes to Donald Trump, what did you expect when presidents of past presidents, Republicans, Democrats, conservatives, liberals, super conservatives, progressives, when they leave the office, they write books. they go out and they find another cause to work on. And this is just Donald Trump. He's not going to write a book. This is what he does. This is what he does. Because he has such really strong supporters, they will spend the $99. So it's a chance for him to make money, and he doesn't have to write a book to do it. I mean, it is classic Donald Trump. That's why whatever Donald Trump does, I'm not surprised, and I won't even roll my eyes because it seems, you know, he's got those supporters that just don't care.
Absolutely. I should say, though, that, you know, now I'm back in Dublin, the Irish Times, I should report, is always attentive to American news. And it's making a point of recording one particular U.S. news item centering on America's Republicans only. It's foregrounded the polling that I know was big news in the U.S. as well, but the Irish are kind of underlining it. The polling by Suffolk University in Boston, commissioned by the USA Today, the Gannett Group newspaper, it says that Ron DeSantis, governor of Florida, is leading Donald Trump as a potential nominee for president in 2024 by an extraordinary 23 percentage points. And I think the Irish Times is wise to underline this. I think we are on the cusp of seeing a shift in the Republican Party. I'm saying that with all the distance of 3,000 miles across the Atlantic, and I may be mistaken, but I think there's lots of evidence gathering now to say that, yes, those people who pay their $99 to have a keepsake of the of Donald Trump for themselves aren't necessarily going to support him as the most likely candidate in the 2024 presidential election.
Well, it will be interesting to watch whether DeSantis can continue his role, and if he does really take the lead, will Donald Trump become an independent candidate for President of the United States? That is always a possibility that would be in the back of his mind, I think.
Yeah, yet more eye-rolling from Europe about that, I'm sure, if that's what happens.
David, it's always great to speak to you. When do you head back to New York City?
Not until the new year. You're going to be talking to me across the Atlantic from now until then.
All right, well, we'll speak to you next week, and we'll take a look back at the previous year and maybe look ahead to a hopefully brighter and better new year ahead. So we'll speak to you next week, David.
Look forward to that.
I'm David Taraschuk with the Media Beat this morning here on Robin Hood Radio, the Robin Hood Radio Network.